Live from Western Canada, welcome to The Kindling's Muse. Intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter most in contemporary life. And now here's your host, Bill Hogg.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies. I am your host, Bill Hogg, Flying Scotsman, intergalactic evangelist, and former talk show host. We're here in South Surrey, located just south of all the Olympics 2010 action at Bell's Restaurant for another soul-stirring edition of The Kindlings, a forum for hospitable, imaginative conversation about ideas that matter in contemporary life. Our topic tonight, as the 2010 Oscars loom large, is faith and film. Tonight's conversation will focus on the Best Picture nominations for the 82nd Academy Awards. We will chat about artistry, technology, spirituality, and the significant stories told by this year's Best Picture nominations. Tonight, we'll explore the big ideas behind this year's Best Picture picks. And just to refresh your memory, those Best Picture picks are Avatar, The Blind Side, District 9, An Education, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, Precious, A Serious Man, Up, and also Up in the Air. This year's nominations see Hollywood exes, former husband and wife, James Cameron and Catherine Bigelow, up against each other for Best Picture for only the second time now. Since Disney's Beauty and the Beast, there is a feature-length animated movie up for Best Picture with Pixar's Up. War is the focus of The Hurt Locker as we follow a bomb disposal unit in Iraq, and World War II gets the inimitable Quentin Tarantino treatment with Inglourious Basterds, and we're treated to dazzling CGI and special effects with Avatar and District 9. Tonight, joining me on our panel are Peter Chataway, Alison Jewell, and Murray Stiller. Peter Chataway is a member of the Vancouver Film Critics Circle, and in addition to an award-winning film column for BC Christian News, he has also written on film for the Vancouver Sun, the Georgia Strait, and a host of other publications. Dr. Alison Jewell is a Kindling's regular. She is author, educator, and co-director of the Gender Studies Institute at Trinity Western University. And joining us for only the second time, wow, it's about a year ago, Murray Stiller, former editing resident of the Canadian Film Centre. Murray Stiller has directed, produced, written, edited, and sound designed films that have been shown around the world. He teaches full-time in the Professional Motion Picture Program at Capilano University and is a sessional professor at Simon Fraser University. His most recent work is Extreme Jesus, a documentary that looks at Christian weightlifters who use their extreme strength as a means of evangelism. So let's talk movies with our most bodacious panel. Firstly, there's been a great deal of hype and excitement generated by Avatar. Why is this film so huge?
I have no idea. I think it's a terrible film. Okay, I can give it the cinematic power, and it was intriguing to watch. It was very visually appealing, but the story was absolute crap, and I found it difficult to just get to the end of it. I thought it was boring.
Okay, boring. Would you mind telling us exactly what you think, Alison? That would be helpful. Murray, this film has been labelled a phenomenon, and it's grossed a huge amount of money at the box office. Why is it such a transcultural phenom?
Oh, I think there's three reasons it's a phenomenon. One, it's James Cameron, and James Cameron only puts out a movie every few years, and when he puts out a movie, it's a spectacle, and everybody knows it's going to be a spectacle. I think it's a phenomenon because there was a surprise about how much money it made. Given the, I would say, not limited, but relatively conservative marketing money that went into it. Usually there's more marketing money that goes into pulling people into the theaters. And this one didn't have as didn't have the same kind of marketing that others might. And third, and I think most importantly, it's a phenomenon because of the technology that it's pushed. James Cameron is always known for all of his films for pushing technology, and this being the first, well, it's not the first 3D film, but it's the first 3D live-action CGI film at this to this capacity. And when we're talking about bringing more three-dimensional films into the theaters and eventually bringing that to television, although I think that 3D television is a long, a further away way than we might assume at this point, because of the technology that he and the people that he's brought in, that's what's made it this a significant phenomenon.
Yeah, I would I would point to the three things the film has going for it as for why it's been such a success. I don't know if anybody remembers, but back in August when they first released the trailer for the movie, people who saw the trailer online laughed at it. They thought it looked hokey. They started calling it Fern Gully, Smurfs, whatever. And
with just cause, because it's a highly derivative film, isn't it, Peter?
Well, they were just responding to the visuals, just the way it looked when you watched it on your computer at home. But then people saw the trailer in theaters, and then people saw the movie at the preview screenings just before it came out in December. And seeing the movie on the big screen, people realized it had a lot more detail, a lot more... it was a visual spectacle like nobody had ever seen, and to get the full effect of it, you had to see it on the big screen. I wonder sometimes, actually, how well the film will do on home video, because I don't think it's made for the home video format. But I think that's partly... I think a lot of people are going to see it in theaters right now because they feel they have to see it now while it's out there. I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is... I mean, Allison, you say the story is crap, and that's certainly a fair response. But I think... As these mega-budgeted blockbuster-type movies go, it actually has one of the most coherent scripts, simple though it may be. It actually has one of the most coherent scripts of these kinds of movies. Compare it to Transformers 2 and tell me... Yeah.
Okay, but...
That's not much of a comparison.
It might not be much of a comparison, but I think that when you look at how a lot of movies are made these days, where the special effects come first and the script is written on the fly... after the movie's made, for all you know. Whereas Cameron, I think, actually does write clean, simple, perhaps too simple stories that hold together over the course of the film. And the third thing I think the film has going for it is you can mock the spirituality in the film all you want as being too new age or too hokey or whatever, but people are responding to the film on that level. And about a month ago, there was a story going around about what they called the Avatar Blues, the idea that people who saw Avatar were feeling very depressed because their life outside the theater was nowhere near as good as the life they saw these characters living in the movie. And
that's crazy.
That's
nuts.
And it may be that the reporters are exaggerating it too. I don't know. But I think people are responding to something in the film that touches them on that kind of level.
Maybe they were depressed because they saw it.
You're not going to cut it any slack.
No. I was so disappointed. I was ready to be amazed because I did go in open-minded. I thought, okay, this could be really cool. And the visuals are cool. That I think is easy to say. But the story wasn't just bad. It was really bad. It wasn't just, it's a simple story. You know, boy meets girl, they fall in love and all is well. It was worse than that. And I thought it was really inconsistent and incoherent. Like, okay, the avatars are bigger than people. Here's an example. Avatars are bigger than people. Okay. But when the Sigourney Weaver character dies in both her real and avatar versions, they look about the same size. But when the moment happens between the female avatar and the marine guy back in the lab when he's in his real body, she's like double his size. I was like, what? What is that? When did that happen? Like, why is there... The size kept changing.
Okay, I don't remember.
No. Yeah.
But that wouldn't be a narrative problem. That would be a problem with the design of the visuals or the whatever.
But it seemed to set up a kind of, there's this other world and it's more magical and it's more amazing and they have these amazing bodies and it's so amazing.
Well, it is visually stunning. I mean, as Murray says, it's groundbreaking in terms of the use of technology. It wouldn't be groundbreaking in terms of its storytelling. You know, so what we're seeing is,
and in fact, I don't think a film that is this groundbreaking technology can take that many chances with its storytelling. I think it has to keep things fairly simple and accessible. Call it lowest common denominator, if you will. But the more fantastic and the more effort gets put into the spectacle side of the film, the more the audience is invited to look at the spectacle. The more important it becomes, more important for the filmmakers to make the story as basic and simple as possible, so that the audience can feel that they are in the story. When you start putting lots of complications and details into the story, it kind of removes the story from the audience, and then the audience has to sort of look at the story and analyze the story.
Yeah, but it wouldn't have to be complicated. It wouldn't have to. Why so cliche? So cliche.
Well, because cliche works. Because as far as the mass theater going audience, the simpler the better. And the more cliché, I'm sorry to say, the better. So as far as all of these other movies, Avatar is kind of the most juvenile of the scripts.
Yes.
But as far as you know, the audience, the 13-year-old to the 30-year-old, who is the largest theater-going audience, this is what they're going to follow
the
easiest.
Should it get the Oscar because it's
no,
the most...
No, I don't think it should get the Oscar.
But is it going to get the Oscar?
I don't think it will.
I think it has a good possibility because I think Hollywood loves the success of the grand spectacle. And this movie this year is the grand spectacle.
Well, it's a grand spectacle. It's a visual feast. And it's one of three movies that deals with the issue of war. So you've got cultural imperialism. You've got military muscle in Avatar. We've got the Hurt Locker with the opening line in the movie, "War is a drug." And, of course, we have Quentin Tarantino with Inglourious Basterds looking at World War II. What are these films saying about war? What kind of war statements are being made, Murray?
Oh, I think they're all making three completely quite different statements. I think it's almost incidental that they're all about war or different ways of dealing with war. Inglourious Basterds is Quentin Tarantino's, I put it politely, his own...
you don't have to be polite.
Quentin Tarantino loves violence for the sake of violence.
Right.
I was going to say his own little public form of masturbation.
Okay, which would be impolite.
That would probably be too far. But however,
but it's
out there now. Yeah, I suppose so. But if he can put it in his head, he feels he can put it on the page. There's nothing. I don't think any kind of positive or redemptive statement going into Inglourious Basterds, although it's a very entertaining film.
I don't know if I wouldn't say that Inglourious Basterds has a statement per se, but I think Inglourious Basterds is designed to mess with the audience a little and to get you thinking about your attraction. I mean, Tarantino is attracted to violence, but I also think he wants you to think about your attraction to violence. I mean, there's a scene in the film where all the Nazis are watching a Nazi propaganda film, and they're all enjoying the violence in the film within the film. And yet the real life person whose life story is being depicted in the propaganda film finds it unsettling, and he has to leave the room. And I think Tarantino has made he's described the movie as a Jewish revenge fantasy. And the thing is, there is a basis, even in the Bible, if you will, for Jewish revenge fantasies. And this raises interesting questions as to how far should we take that? Do those still apply to us now today? And I think Tarantino's made the film partly to make us think about those kinds of things.
Wow.
That's generous. I hope so. I hope so. Because it is provoking.
Oh, yeah, it is.
But I don't know that, you know, you feel like you're repulsed by the violence. Of all the people I've talked to, nobody's talked about being repulsed by the violence, but kind of celebrating it.
I don't see how you can watch the movie without feeling at least some repulsion. I mean, the sadism on display is clearly stomach-churning. And I think Tarantino means it to be somewhat stomach-churning, which is not to say he doesn't enjoy it on some level, but that I don't know. I find it hard to say that it's just a straight celebration of violence. I certainly wouldn't call it a condemnation of violence. But I don't think we can go the other way and say that it's a straight celebration of it either.
Probably I spend too much time with university students, so
maybe that's it. But what about the Hurt Locker, where it's been well received by members of the U.S. Armed Forces who've seen it, and one critic called it a pro-army movie. But we see war as dehumanizing. You know, the central figure is Staff Sergeant William James, played by Jeremy Renner. And he can't settle down. You know, he's got a beautiful wife. He's got a baby boy. He has what Sergeant J.T. Sanborn longs for, a family. But he's hooked on the adrenaline rush of dismantling a bomb. And so it's kind of odd to me that U.S. armed personnel are so generous in their praise of this film, when it seems to me it's a critique of war. It dehumanizes you. It makes you incapable of relationships. He's kind of on just like the opening statement, war is a drug.
Well, I'm surprised that you would have said that he returned or he continues because of an adrenaline rush, because when I was watching the film, I thought it was a more complex view of the confusion. And I thought, as a feminist scholar, that the fact that it was directed by a woman made it particularly a fresh look at what's going into the whole enterprise of trying to sort this out. That the adrenaline rush wasn't the same as open battle.
Well, it's like he comes alive, he takes the uniform off, the gloves off, so he runs the risk of his hands being blown off.
I thought it was...
And he's there kind of in a chess game, because the person who placed the bomb is watching nearby, and so he's demonstrating in a kind of machismo way that he can...
But it was more cerebral. To me, it appeared more cerebral than physical, adrenaline-pumping kind of scenes. Like, there was something... There was something smarter.
Well, he's attracted to the danger. You might want to compare it, say, to something like gambling addiction, where there's always that risk of losing the bet, and maybe he's drawn to that kind of danger, being on the edge. Being on the edge is where things matter more. Because at the end of the film, near the end of the film, when he comes home to America, he's bewildered. He goes to a grocery store, and there are these huge aisles full of food, and it's all very peaceful and orderly, and he doesn't know what to do with that.
But none of us should know what to do with that.
Okay, well, and his response to that is to go back to the battlefield, where he will be in danger all the time, because at least there he's improvising, he's thinking, he's alive.
He can't deal with domesticity, so he can't deal with, it's not enlivening enough to be doing household chores, playing with his son, or dealing with the grocery store. He's got to get back, because there's this device in the film where there's the countdown of how long the tour of duty lasts, which you would think every combatant would long to get home. But he's back, he signs up, he re-enlists, he's back in for the thrill.
Yeah, but wasn't that, I thought that was a unique portrayal of a hero, that there was something he could offer this complicated, strange world that was going to help to some extent in a way that was new in this time of warfare, that made it different from Apocalypse Now or Saving Private Ryan, that there was something... that we're in new terrain with intelligence and technology that made it a different kind of story.
I think he's certainly a hero, but I think he's more of an anti-hero. He's a hero, and he's our main character. But I got the more sense of it's the alienation that this character is kind of living in and choosing to live in. The last shot is him walking down this long street all by himself. This is where he likes to be. All alone with the bombs.
But wasn't it sort of an existentialist film? That there was, several points when it's like, well, if we're all going to die anyway, I'm going to take off my
equipment. So it counts about just being alive in the moment then?
Yeah, and yeah. I thought that made the movie profound. Because we're all in I'm not in that war, but the whole existentialist reality of trying to cope with a nonsensical world with nonsensical issues, even the bewildering scene in the... grocery store was one I related to. Why are we looking at all these cereals? But the whole world itself is crazy.
I would take it one step further than existentialist. It's a narcissist journey that this guy is in. He's selfishly looking for that alienation where he can be. He can get rid of, you know, all the love and the, you know, the women that want to love him and the friends that are around him, the guys that he's supposed to be with. And in the end, he alienates himself from them as well.
Even his own fellow soldiers debate whether or not to kill him. I mean, even his own comrades don't seem to like him very much.
But couldn't
much.
He be, that he's being more honest than they're capable of being about the craziness of it?
Sure, so honest in a narcissistic
lonely.
Way.
Yeah, we're all
I like
we're
being
all
alienated.
Alone.
Everybody get away from me, and I'll push everybody away by threatening their lives.
Or instead of I like being alone,
with their bombs.
Not instead of I like being alone, I am alone. We are all alone.
Oh, I am selfishly wanting to be alone.
Well, I've got to selfishly interrupt because it's time for a break. We'll take a break here at the Kindlings, and we'll be back in a moment for more lively conversation around the issues raised by this year's Best Picture nominations. Thank you. Welcome back to the Kindlings Western Canada. I'm your friendly neighbourhood host, Bill Hogg, in conversation with movie maker and film prof Murray Stiller. Stiller?
Sure.
That'll work. Stiller, Murray Stiller?
They'll figure it out.
Okay, they'll figure it out. Alison Jewell, who was particularly feisty before the break, I thought. Maybe that's because she is waxing eloquent on an empty stomach and hasn't yet enjoyed her dinner here at Bell's. And Peter Chatterway, our Canadian encyclopedia of all things cinematic, who's never short of something worthwhile and insightful to say. Before the break, we were locking antlers over the Hurt Locker, but as you look across the 10 Best Picture nominations, do you see any common themes or trends emerging or common issues or common statements that are being made?
Well, to pick up from what we just left off with, the sense of alienation. You know, an education, Hurt Locker, Precious, A Serious Man, up in the air. That seems to be a common theme throughout. Where the characters, the lead characters, are withholding themselves or intentionally trying to push people away for various reasons, whether they're selfish or whether they're just reactionary to, you know, their world.
And in Up, not only alienation, but the idea of marriage as a long-term permanent commitment is kind of placed there as a subtext, isn't it? Because you've got this romance and this very moving, wordless movement in Up about the love between a husband and a wife.
Just for that sequence alone, that should win the Academy Award for Best Film, where you train all this going from the young boy to the old man and his life, and it was just a great sequence.
Well, that's one way to put it. I would say if it weren't for that sequence, nobody would be talking about it for Best Picture. But anyway, whatever. I like Up, but I can't give it Best Picture myself. But that's a
Well, thankfully, it's not down to you, Peter.
No, so, I know, so I know.
It might still be in with a shout. But you've got this crusty old geezer, Fredrickson, who's attached to his house as a metaphor for grief and baggage. So you've got this baggage, and at one point, he's dragging around this huge house with a garden hose. Then you've got this kind of naif, selfless little boy who's got an empty backpack. He's got little baggage. And then if you go to Up in the Air, you've got George Clooney's character who gives seminars about what you should or shouldn't put in the rucksack. So there's an interesting kind of thread of baggage or how we deal with our baggage.
Yeah. You've also got a common theme in The Blind Side and Precious, both of which are about some people have said they're both about overweight black teens from bad backgrounds, but which is true, not the most, you know...
True, but unkind,
not,
Peter.
Not the best way to put it. Hey, I didn't coin the expression. But yeah, but both of them deal with teenagers from problematic backgrounds, and both of them essentially have to leave their families, and they do it, both of them find some degree of liberation through education. educations of different kinds in different contexts, but there's a commonality there between those two films as well.
And in The Blind Side, you've got the transforming power of hospitality, that this boy who would be labeled a loser is brought into what we know as a Christian home. It's not terribly explicit in the film, but it's there. But this affluent white Republican family open up their doors to this boy who can barely read, and they help him to get on. What did you think of the depiction of Sandra Bullock's character, you know, as a strong woman, a kind of matriarch driving the story?
Yeah, I thought she was great. I enjoyed her best in the film. In a way, it was a little bit... the Julia Roberts character...
Erin Brockovich?
Erin Brockovich. It felt like the same kind of feisty woman who sees the wrong and makes it right. So in that sense, it was a bit derivative. I was most intrigued with the depiction of women in Up in the Air and in An Education. I mean, as well as Precious, but Precious had so much trauma that in even though I was absolutely intrigued by the story, it was almost too painful to watch and relate to, even though I felt like I had to give witness to it as a woman. But I felt that the characters in Up in the Air, the two women in Up in the Air, and the main character in an Education, I thought they were very intriguing women to watch, more intriguing than Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side, even though I found her entertaining and intriguing. But so
What did you find intriguing about the females in Up in the Air?
Okay, well, the one woman played by... who was the...
Andra Kendricks plays Natalie Keener.
And then Vera...
Okay, the Vera Faminga character, who has the no ties here, we're just going to have a fun affair. And then she's the one who sort of turns the table because he falls for her and follows her to her home in Boston. And then she, actually is already married with children. So, what, you know, I thought that was an interesting kind of twist on what would be the usual scenario of...
That a woman gets played by the male player.
Yeah. And that she kind of takes him to task on it, saying, well, I mean, why were you expecting any more? I mean, why would you even come here? Even though she does go to the family wedding with him, which I thought was a little bit, you know, outside the usual bounds of an affair. So I thought...
You kind of thought they were moving forward
relationally
at that point.
Yeah, I did. So I thought she was mean. She was cruel. And that was an unusual portrayal of women, which I appreciated seeing.
Wow.
I also thought, well, let's just show variety, right? Let's just show variety. No one on a pedestal. I also thought that the young woman had some interesting twists and turns in her own character. I was most intrigued with An Education, though. That was just the coming of age of a young woman, not usually seen on the big screen like that. I thought that was fascinating to watch, and I thought it had some interesting sort of both familiar but also particular issues within it.
Well, Up in the Air went into kind of unfamiliar territory because I don't think we've ever seen a main character who is a hired gun who comes in and lays people off. He's a kind of professional layer offer, if there is such a word, where the management don't have the huevos to dispose of their employees, so they bring him in, and the people that you see reacting weren't professional actors, but were actually people they used who were recently let go, and they were given a bit of improvisational space to say, okay, what happened, or how would you have liked that scene to play out in the office when you were told that you no longer had a job at the company you'd served for the past 27 years. What was your take on Up in the Air, Murray?
Well, it was same director and almost a similar kind of a character, or a similar kind of hero's journey as Thank You for Not Smoking.
Thank You for Smoking.
Thank You for Smoking. Yes. Thank You for Smoking? Yeah. Yes, right. Mm-hmm. So it's been a few years, but it was almost kind of the same sort of humor and shot in kind of the same kind of way. So it was interesting to see the director.
Jason Reitman.
Thank you very much. I knew it was an easy one. You know, kind of following through kind of the same theme. And I think you probably find a lot of directors are find a theme that really interests them or intrigues them, that they continue to explore from film to film.
And I think that's why I find some of the other films more engaging as story and character, because you look at these sort of new scenarios and find them intriguing and interesting to watch, like Up in the Air or An Education or even Precious. Like, wow, this is new terrain that I haven't had to confront. And as a moviegoer, I find that worth my while. And I think that's why I'm so mad at Avatar, that it took my time and money, and it had nothing new to say.
Okay, you just managed to slip that one in there.
Okay. Sure. Okay, just James Cameron chooses simple films, simple stories, simple ideas.
Someone should stop him.
He's a businessman who understands his market.
He sure does. He makes a movie every 12 years.
Thank goodness.
You'll be fine.
But in terms of fresh narrative terrain, what about District 9? Where you have aliens who aren't going to dominate the planet, but they're sick, they're weak, they're diseased, they become slum dwellers, they're refugees, they're powerless. So that's a kind of new take on how Earth deals with life out there.
Well, some people have compared it to Avatar because both films are about, a white man, a member of the establishment, who goes native and on some level finds himself becoming the other, becoming the aliens, the Na'vi in Avatar, or becoming one of the aliens in District 9.
Or John Dunbar in Dances with Wolves.
Similarities perhaps, but...
Okay, I'll talk to you off your game. Go ahead,
that's
Peter.
Fine. District 9, I find... I think one of the most fascinating things about District 9, personally, is the fact that it was such a relatively low-budget film, and it had a certain ingenuity on the technical level with all the effects, but because it was so low-budget, they were able to take chances with the story. And so they were able to say, you know what, we're going to make a movie set in South Africa. We're going to deal with like a century's worth of South African politics, not just apartheid, but also... there's references to the concentration camps the British built there at the turn of the century. There is the subtext of Zimbabwean refugees coming into South Africa. There's all this stuff going on, and they were able to deal with all that in a movie like this because it was made fairly cheaply. And the fact that those kinds of effects and that kind of technical proficiency is possible on a relatively low budget. $30 million may not seem low to you, Murray. I'm sure your films don't cost that much. But when you compare it to something like Avatar, which cost like $250 million, when you've got budgets like that, you can't take a lot of chances. And District 9 was able to take chances, and people responded to that. And it was a much bigger hit than anybody thought it would be. And partly because they were able to take those kinds of chances.
And it is the technology that is significant of these few films from this year. Even though, yeah, District 9, $30 million, the core of it was significantly less. I don't know if $30 million includes the marketing capital that
possibly
went into
not,
it.
But
it's shocking what you can do with software now. And, you know, it costs next to nothing. I teach some software After Effects at the college, and the things that I see kids doing with the software is something we couldn't have done 5 years ago. And what's important about I think District 9 and Avatar is now we're taking our expectation of what we can do with the software and what stories we can incorporate, thinking even further outside the box. I think that's what's going to be important to storytelling in the next 10 years.
I think also one of the interesting trends you can see across these Best Picture nominees is that a lot of them simply do not have stars. The whole star system thing is really being called into question these days. Avatar, if anything, made stars of some of its lead actors. Sam Worthington has since been seen in Terminator and other movies, but he actually got the job in Terminator after he made Avatar. It's just that Avatar took so long to finish because of all the effects that Terminator came out before Avatar did. And Zoe Saldana, same thing. She did Star Trek after she did Avatar, but Avatar took so long. And then you also find Hurt Locker. I mean, okay, there are a few relatively big names who show up for 5 minutes here or 5 minutes there, but it's not a star-driven movie at all. A Serious Man, made by the Coen brothers. Are there any stars in that one? I mean, maybe one or two recognizable characters.
They want the story to drive the film then, because you're not bedazzled by star power.
Yeah.
Or the technology to drive the film.
And Precious. I mean, Precious is getting a lot of attention because you have Monique, who's, you know, fairly well known for her talk show and things. She plays the mother in that film. But again, Precious is not sold primarily on her. It's more about the story, the lead character. Nobody had heard of that actress beforehand. And that seems to be one of the common themes running through a lot of these, I think.
You mentioned A Serious Man, so let's talk about that. It's supposedly a dark comedy, which I personally didn't find particularly funny. You've got Larry Gopnik, played by this unknown actor who was known for his stage work before. It's kind of like Job, set in suburban Minneapolis circa 1967. Life has no certainties. We cannot understand God's plan or God's will. And you've got the journey of a man who seeks the wisdom and counsel of three rabbis, one who refuses to see him, the junior rabbi who's full of inane platitudes, and then one who tells him a pointless story about a goyim who's been serviced by a Jewish dentist, and inside his teeth is a message in Hebrew, and the characters spell out, "Help me" or "Save me." So what are the Coens actually trying to say? Because now they're successful enough, they can kind of be self-indulgent. Let's just play around with this. Are they actually seriously trying to raise spiritual questions about God, knowing God, God's will, God's plan, God's purpose?
I don't know if I'd call the film spiritual. I think there may be a theological angle to the film, which to me implies something a little different. But I've only seen the film once, and I'd have to see it again before I could even begin to really get into it. But my favorite comment on the film is by an acquaintance of mine who he looks at. There's a lot of parallels in the film. I mean, you mentioned that it takes place in 1967. Well, that's the year of the Six-Day War. And if memory serves, isn't the main character dealing with his next-door neighbor infringing on his property? And so there's all these issues, whether it's modern politics or ancient biblical texts, all these things that are part of being a Jew in the late 20th century that are all brought together in this film, and it just stirs them up. But
it's also a personal drama. Life is unraveling. Willie won't get tenure. His wife wants his best friend to move in on him.
And there's an element of the David and Bathsheba thing where he stands on his roof and sees the neighbor sunbathing in the nude and all that stuff.
Right.
My favorite comment on the film is by a friend of mine pointed out that one of the things that comes up in the film is this notion of Schrodinger's cat. You know, the physicist, I think it was, who said that, I forget why, I'm not a physicist, forgive me, but there's this famous idea that if there's a cat in a box, you don't know if the cat is alive or dead until you open the box. Mm-hmm. And uncertainty is a big theme throughout this film. And the uncertainty, is there a God, is there not a God? And a friend of mine said something very interesting, where he said that if you look at the Schrodinger's cat idea as an analogy for religion, if religion is the box, the question is God alive or dead? And the answer may be both. Which I thought was a really interesting comment. What does it mean? Is God alive in our traditions?
Right.
In our religion, or does our religion somehow kill God, or does our religion distance us from God? And it can be one, it can be the other, it can be the same for both. It can be both for us, but at different times, or it can be, I don't know.
And you've got religion as a unifying force because it's the bar mitzvah where his son, who admittedly is stoned because he's just been doing doobies with his friend, does his bar mitzvah.
And he's reciting scripture while stoned. So he really isn't thinking about what he's reading at all. He's just reading it.
But meanwhile, Larry Gopnik and his wife are beginning to reconnect because of this religious rite of passage. What were you going to say, Mike?
I was going to say, Peter's comment of the box, or, you know, is God alive in spite of our religion? You know, does God still exist, you know, in spite of the trappings of this tradition, these traditions that really break down in the film when our hero's main character's wife wants a religious divorce which allows her and the friend to go off and get married without going against the synagogue. And you know, he's kind of thrown up his hands and kind of said, I guess so. But throughout it all, it's another existential journey of alienation, I think, because the character is continually alienated from everybody and everything around him, whether it's at work or it's his wife or his kids for various reasons, and then his friends, and he's left alone, leading us right up until the very end of the movie where, you know, so you might not be happy with the end of the movie because you don't exactly know what's going to happen, but it doesn't look great in spite of the fact that he's resolved some of these relationships around him.
Well, the last scene kind of looks like Job chapter 1 is going to play out where the storm will flatten the building and kill his children. But the interesting thing you say, Murray, about the alienation theme, but he's frustrated, he's angry, he's bewildered, but he doesn't seem to succumb to bitterness, which is intriguing. You know, he's still on the quest.
He's at that point where he's numb to a lot of things, and it's part of his character that he doesn't lash out like everybody else around him seems to do, but he's just kind of confused and seems to be like he's being punched. He's kind of blindsided. He doesn't know what to do to move to the next step, but he still goes ahead. And when he finally decides he's got a way out to take some of this money, some of this bribe money that one of his students has given him, that trips him up immediately. Of all of these films, this is my favorite film of the year. I really enjoyed it, partly because it's a Coen Brothers movie, and I don't think the Coens can do any wrong. But just as far as a filmmaker, and I look at it and go, it has an incredible sense of
the Lady Killers, no wrong. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't get into
it. It was. I enjoyed it more than most people did, but that was a bit of a cheap shot.
What did you think of Precious?
Well, let me finish. A Simple Man. It has a great sense of rhythm to it. It's slow, but it's deliberate, and you get the feeling that every single shot and every single camera angle and every single emotion is intentionally placed and allowed to develop kind of in this kind of almost organic kind of sense. That one thing flows to the next, and there's no illogic to it. Even though the story is a bit of an unusual one and takes a lot of little twists and turns, it's got a great flow to it, and I think the Coen Brothers have done a great job. But it'll never get it won't win an Oscar, and I think it's probably the one movie that fewest people have seen.
Well, Murray Stiller says A Serious Man has a great flow to it. We've got to flow into a break right now. We'll be right back, and our illustrious panel will be tackling the questions and comments posed by our audience. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies. We are at Bells in South Surrey. We are part of the Kindlings Western Canada. You can find us on the web at thekindlings.ca. And I'm in conversation about this year, 2010's Best Picture nominations from the Academy Awards, the 82nd Academy Awards, with our panelists, Alison Jewell, Peter Chataway, and Murray Stiller. And we're going to hear from our enlightened audience with their questions about movies. So we're going to go to Kerry, first of all, who's just put some dessert in her mouth. So we'll let her swallow and reflect thoughtfully before she gives voice to her own question. Kerry.
All right, my question was, do movies show too much, like the sexual nature of Precious and the violence in Inglourious Basterds? Is it making... is it just pushing the envelope too much and desensitizing people or making them too curious about all what goes on with that kind of thing?
Thanks, Kerry.
Yes and no.
Spoken like a politician.
I'll sign up for the Green Party next year. Yes and no. As a filmmaker, I am trying to work this delicate balance between showing enough to intrigue you, but withholding enough so that your imagination does most of the work. And I think that's what makes for a really good film. Sure, people go overboard and show too much, but as a society, we're always trying to figure out where is too much and what is, you know, where should we be allowed to kind of see as much as we can express. So, you know, the artist side of me is kind of balanced between saying, yes, we shouldn't censor, but there is a moment where, yes, it's unhealthy, but also the artist in me is, as I'm creating something where I'm wanting you and the audience to get involved with the film, I need to leave room for the audience's interpretation and kind of creative impulse.
I think it's interesting, the two examples you mentioned in particular. I think that Inglourious Basterds, I think Tarantino is actually trying to make the audience squirm. I think he's counting on the audience not being desensitized. And do other films go too far? Perhaps. But I think in the case of that particular film, Tarantino is kind of deliberately going too far. And he knows he's going too far. And he knows that you know he's going too far and so forth. And I think that's part of what makes the film, but in an ironic way, that's part of what makes it successful. It's one of those things people want to see and talk about. You know, oh, what did you think about that? Did it go too far? And that's part of the appeal of it in a way.
So, just to follow up with what you're saying before you talk to Precious, Peter, how can you make a statement or how can you evaluate that Tarantino is going too far and he knows he's going too far because he wants to... How do you arrive at that kind of analysis or evaluation of Tarantino's work?
Well, I think any film that shows a guy deliberately beating somebody else's head in with a baseball bat over and over again and builds up to it by having the person come out of a cave walking very slowly, tapping his baseball bat against the wall of the cave, you know, building up that sense of dread, and then finally committing the violence. Now, mind you, when the actual hitting begins, I think Tarantino cuts to a much wider angle further back so that we're not as up close to the violence as we could be. On the other hand, at the very end of the film, when the characters carve a swastika into a Nazi's forehead, it's an extremely tight close-up on the forehead as the swastika is being carved into the guy's skin, as I recall. It's been a few months. And the Nazi himself is screaming. And just, I find that kind of screaming very unpleasant. And I think most audience members do. So I think there's an element of going too far with that. As for Precious, again, it's been a few months since I've seen it, but I don't remember there being a lot of sex. I remember the sex that is seen being shown extremely briefly in these very brief sort of 5-second shots, flashbacks. Like but the thing is, the kind of sex that we know it is very disturbing. And I think the film has to give us a sense of the disturbingness of it in order to experience the character's point of view.
What about the baby thrown, fallen scene?
Well, that's not sex, though.
No, but it's sort of pushing...
Oh, violence, though.
It's a kind of violence.
That would be violence, Peter.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Some people would say it goes too far. Some people think the film goes a little over the top by making Precious's mother like an out-and-out monster, that it's hard to take the movie seriously because that character is so extremely over the top. That's a valid response.
But do you think it needs to go over the top to make the point that there are, you know, situations that are hell on earth and the average person has no idea?
Possibly, but I think in a case like that, you make it almost too easy for the audience to say, move out of there, get out of that apartment, leave your mother, because she's so obviously wrong for you. And I think a more effective film might be one in which you kind of understand why somebody might stay in that apartment, or why a film in which the parent is abusive sometimes, but not all the time, and that there's something that still connects the parent and the child, and that leaving that parent behind might actually be difficult for the child. I think that kind of film could arguably be more effective, but Precious, by making the mother such an outright monster, kind of simplifies things a little, maybe.
Alison, just to let you weigh in on the issue that Kerry raised, do you think movie makers are shown too much? There's too much violence, graphic violence,
My first response is no. Like, thinking of the Precious movie, I found it very difficult to sit through, but I also felt that it took me out of my fairly comfortable life that had nothing to do with that film and forced me to face something that some people do live with. So in a way, it needed to make me sit there. I mean, I appreciate the point that it went over the top and that it became its own weird caricature of, you know, craziness and who lives with that kind of craziness. But I don't think it could have told that story without showing that kind of violence in all its many forms. I mean, generally, I think I was more upset with the Avatar women than I was with Precious.
Here we go again.
Yeah, here we go again. Yeah. I just thought, what the heck went on with the female Avatar characters who looked about 12 in their developmental phase, and yet they were meant to be women. I hate that. And all the...
Well, they're not human, you know.
Well, I know, but the female...
That's a helpful distinction.
Okay, yeah, but the male Avatar looked pretty masculine, but the female Avatar looked pretty adolescent, and the male Avatar, you know, masculine male areas were well protected, but the female anatomy was, you know, kind of played with, and that always seems to happen. And that bugs me more than...
because that's what the audience wants to see, though, isn't it?
Really? What? I mean, what does... yeah. I don't...
You don't,
I find it very...
But you're not the 15 to 30-year-old target
what?
Audience.
I think that it sets up a double standard that women portrayed on film are always the ones to be observed and always the ones to be, you know, desired or lusted after, and therefore the standards are always incredibly impossible. And everyone sits there and desiring that body type, whether they're male and want it or female and wish they had it. It's just, I just find it always this weird. Okay, here's one other example.
Are you seeing that just because you're not part of James Cameron's target demographic?
I think I'm not saying it just because of that. I think there's a general tendency for that. But in the James Cameron film, I thought, Sigourney Weaver, when it first starts, I thought, oh, Sigourney Weaver, you know, she's looking a little older, and yeah, I can kind of relate to that, and I really appreciate that she looked really real. And then, oh, she appears in Avatar form, and she's like this weird Bo Derek kind of short shorts, like, what the heck happened to Sigourney Weaver? And, you know, that bothers me.
I didn't notice that. Oh, maybe it's because to the pure, all things are pure.
maybe that's it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. maybe that's it. Wow, Alison manages to get another shot in at James Cameron in Avatar. Yeah. Way to go, every single segment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We love you because you're so consistent.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got another question which has nothing at all to do with Avatar.
Oh, it probably does.
From Scott.
Alison will find a way.
Yeah.
I don't know whether this is really a question or a comment or take it for what it is, but I just think that we might be looking a little too deeply as to what makes a movie good.
No, impossible. That's impossible.
Movies are made to entertain us, to take us away with a story, a spectacle, a lesson, etc. My example is that Disney's made insane amounts of money recycling the same story over and over and over again. Why? Because it works. Right? For entertainment value alone, Avatar deserves Oscar consideration, albeit with a simple formulaic story. You don't have to change the world to entertain or to make a quality film.
My guess is that most of you are here not to talk about films because you're entertained by them. My guess is you're interested in talking about films because you've experienced something. You've experienced some kind of catharsis that helped you to see something beyond yourself. And I think that's the difference between Avatar, something that's just out for entertainment, and a film that's actually trying to say something either personal from the filmmaker's experience or trying to say something that is trying to change the world. And I'd get one plug in here that's not on our list we were talking about today. If you're going to go see a really great film that's up for Oscar, Food Inc. There's a film that's, if that film doesn't change your life, I don't know what will.
Yeah, but that's a documentary, though.
It's I'm talking about documentary, but I'm saying the point is that the cathartic experience that we've all shared that's made us intrigued with film, cinema.
Just to go back to Avatar, because we must. I mean, Avatar, yes, it's made to entertain, but James Cameron's very open about the fact that he had an actual message, that he had an agenda, if you will, that he wants to encourage better stewardship of creation. Those might not be his exact words, but still, that is very much the idea he's trying to put in people's minds. And I don't think we can. I just want to be fair to the film and say it's not just entertainment. Even that film, even a film like that, has a message or an idea it's trying to get across. And like I said, a lot of people are responding to the film on some very deep personal level, which I think is a little absurd in some ways. But you know, the whole Avatar Blues thing—the idea that this movie presents a perfect world, a wonderful world—and I have to leave this theater now and go back to this world, which
and
I find
and
very
I can't
strange.
Fly because, on the back of a dragon.
Well, I find it very strange because Avatar spends the first half hour convincing you that all the animals on this planet want to kill you and eat you, and then after that we get all the utopian stuff. But I never quite shake off that other stuff. That
no, that's
comes
true.
At the beginning.
And it was a cheap shot to Avatar. But the point being is that yes, there's that entertainment aspect to it, but there is this thing that has kind of changed us, and we've all felt it when we've been caught up in a movie, in a film. So it does step one, it does go one step beyond entertainment, and I don't think our conversation is about the entertainment aspect of it, but what is that deeper level?
Well, or also when you look at a film like Pixar's Up, I mean, people respond to that film because of its very powerful portrayal of a marriage that lasts many decades, and then of the development of new connections between the old man and the young boy, the boy who doesn't have a father at the moment. His father has left his mother and gone somewhere else. And people respond to that element of human connection in the film. And was Up made to entertain? Absolutely. But it was also made with a sensitivity to some of these deeper things, and I think audiences are responding to that.
And it's the difference between kitsch and good art, and then great art.
But kitsch moves me too sometimes.
Yeah, I can be moved by
it
kitsch.
It entertains me.
Okay.
I mean, I can admit that I'm not the demographic, yes, that Avatar is going for, but I didn't expect to be quite so annoyed. And I don't think I was alone with it. In other words, it could have entertained me quite nicely. I was really open to be nicely entertained, and I like kind of the science fiction thing, and I like getting out of my own world and into another world. That part I'm really, you know, a good participant in. I could really go there. Good sport. I just think that he should know better, and people spending that kind of money on that kind of story should at least not wallow in the kind of cliche, and in that sense I felt insulted. I was there to watch it, I had my glasses on, I'd paid the money, and I was ready to be entertained, but I don't want to be insulted at the same time. I like it when it has some transcendent power, like, let's say, Star Wars, because it's another discussion, but, you know, I think it can be fantasy, science fiction, and still have a very powerful story. And I didn't think Avatar came through.
All right, there's Allison on Avatar. While we're talking about Avatar, Dave Brett has a question, comment for our most bodacious panel.
Thank you. Yeah, just another Avatar question. To the political agenda of Avatar, I happen to be in the mining industry, and the bad guy in Avatar is a mining company. Has the evil corporation run amok become the new villain in Hollywood? And what is really James Cameron trying to preach to us? It's got quasi-religious overtones, trying to convert us to a new system of belief in the power of transcendent nature, et cetera, Mother Earth, triumphing over greed, etc.
One of my favorite films ever, at least in the sci-fi genre, is Aliens, which was the second or third, depending on how you count, movie that James Cameron made. And in Aliens, the villain in that film is also a corporation. And one of the things, one of the reasons why I find Avatar disappointing on a story level is because James Cameron has repeated himself but dumbed things down. the corporate person played by Paul Reiser, of all people, in Aliens, is comes across as a friendly kind of guy at first. And over the course of the film, more and more is revealed about him, and he turns out to be a bit of a coward and a weasel and so forth. Whereas in Avatar, there is no question, from the very first time we see him, this corporate guy is a bad guy, and that's it. That's all there is to him. He's just a bad guy. So the corporation as villain is a theme that's been around for a while. And largely because people have this perception that corporations are just interested in dollars. And that, if you will, there is something nihilistic about capitalism, that everything boils down to dollars and cents. And that people working in that system don't look at any other way of measuring the value or the meaning of a thing. And Michael Moore has said, if you see the documentary, The Corporation, Michael Moore, who I don't normally try to agree with, but he has said that as evidence of this, as evidence of the fact that corporations don't place any value on anything other than money, all you have to do is look at the success of Michael Moore's films, which have been picked up by corporations and distributed by corporations, because the corporations know that his anti-corporate movies will make money for them.
Does it matter what the corporation is? Like, it is the mining versus Mother Earth tension different than, you know, Coca-Cola Corporation conversation?
What would Coca-Cola be opposed to? I mean, the movie
dental hygiene, probably.
Avatar sets up a conflict between humanity, which has become overrun by corporate concerns, and all it's interested in is the quarterly statement, is what the character says in the film. And the aliens represent something that is more connected to the Earth, something that is more connected. People are connected to each other.
The aliens or the avatars?
Well, the Na'vi.
The Avatar is a genetically engineered body that allows the humans to move in the alien environment.
But they're not the aliens on their own Pandora world.
No, they're the indigenous
people.
Well,
you can call them the natives.
Just clarifying, that's all.
Speaking directly to his question, though, bad guys, yep, you're the bad guy this year for Hollywood. You know?
Okay.
And anybody going against the kind of the ecological balance, they're the bad guys. Mining are the bad guys this year. Next year, it'll be Wall Street.
But Dave,
remember, it takes a year or two to make a film. We had the Wall Street crash. Give it a couple of years, there'll be a new series of bad guys, and you'll be off the hook.
It's not just the mining corporation and Avatar. Look at District 9. District 9, a key element in that film is that the corporation that the one guy works for, when he begins to sort of mutate into an alien, they immediately look at him as though he were just like raw material to be analyzed in their labs.
Okay, what about the men in the other films that were the bad guys? Men in Precious, men in An Education, bad guys.
Bad guys.
Well, that's why they're guys. They're bad guys.
More threatening.
It's feminist stereotyping of men. Maybe that's what it is, Allison. Okay, as we wrap up this conversation and move away from the bad guys in pursuit of unobtainium and the bad guys in District 9, final comment from our panelists. We've reviewed a number of films, chatted about themes generated, but what was the most redemptive movie you saw and why? So think about that and then give me some quick fire comment from the hip.
Okay, I'm going to go with Up in the Air, and I'm going to go with that one because of its portrayal of women, and that women are not on a pedestal, nor should they be, and women are people. That's a rather extraordinary thought, and I thought that it presented it well in that film. That, to me, was maybe the most redemptive, that we're people, flawed and all.
Redemptive, even although you said they were nasty in the second segment?
Yeah.
Okay.
Women are people.
Just clarifying.
Women
are people.
That's a redemptive thought.
Okay. Right. Thanks, Allison. Peter.
Does it have to be one of these 10 here, or can I just say whatever the best film of the year was?
Say whatever you like.
Okay. All
in
right.
In 12 seconds. Okay. No, I'm just teasing.
Okay. Yeah. I would say the two best films that played in Vancouver this year, to my money, one was a film called Summer Hours from France, and it's all about a family dealing with basically the grandmother and mother character dies, and then they all have to deal with her inheritance. And it gets into all these really interesting issues about how we assign value to things, the cultural forces affecting the family, yada, yada, yada. Great film. The other one is a movie called Munyarangabo. It's made in Rwanda, but it's made by an American who went to Rwanda with a YWAM team and shot a film there with local Rwandans. First film ever made in the local native dialect. And it played at art house theaters around the world because it's a really, really cool film, and it's very redemptive, I would say.
All right. Thanks, Peter. And Murray, what's your pick for the most redemptive film in the year that's gone by?
And I can't push my own film, can I? No, I'm kidding. I'm going to stay with the list because that's where I thought you were going. I'm going to say Up. The relationship between the old man and the young boy, and what the old man has to give up to rescue the young boy at the end.
All right, sounds good. Well, my thanks to Alison Jewell, Peter Chataway, and Murray Stiller. Thanks so much for your comments and joining us at the Kindlings. And thank you, audience, for joining us. Check out the website in the next 24, 48 hours. Go to thekindlings.ca. We've got blogs, we've got archived audio content, and this show will be uploaded in short order. Join us next month, the last Monday in March, for The Gospel According to The Simpsons. So we kind of unpack why The Simpsons have such enduring appeal 20 years on, and what is the message behind The Simpsons. Thanks so much. We'll be right back.